You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Americans have gotten so accustomed to hearing bad news about Iraq that many were surprised to read last week in the New York Times that its government had assumed responsibility for keeping the peace in the Anbar province. Linda Robinson credits General David H. Petraeus and the conventional and unconventional tactics he's used with having dramatically reduced violence in the former stronghold of the Sunni insurgency. Ms. Robinson, who's covered the conflict in Iraq as a senior writer for the U.S. News and World Report, has just returned from her latest reporting trip there, and she has a new book called Tell Me How This Ends. It's published by Public Affairs, and I'm pleased that it brings Linda Robinson back to the show today. Hi.
Hi, Leonard.
You were scheduled to be a guest here last week, but I understand you got stuck in Kuwait. What happened?
Yes, actually got stuck in Baghdad, unfortunately, and I do apologize. The charter flight that I was supposed to take from Baghdad to Kuwait had a mechanical problem, and so the plane literally didn't arrive till the next day. And I've had some flights out of Baghdad in the past years canceled or turned around mid-flight due to ground fire and fighting. And this was, at least this time, it was pure mechanical error.
Well, I've often heard that one of the most dangerous places in the world is that airport because the planes have to take off in a way that they don't normally take off.
Yes, that's right. They spiral down and they go up at a very steep angle. And that was very frequently, that was true until really last August, a year ago.
How many times have you interviewed General Petraeus?
Gee, at least 10 times. And we were in touch by phone and email. I've totaled the time there up. It's about 10 months on the ground since the beginning of the war. And I've gone about roughly every 6 months, although when I started the book, I went more frequently. And I would always try to stay 3 to 4 weeks so I could get a real sense of what was going on the ground.
When you started the book, it was going to be about General Petraeus, or is that what took over?
Yes. No, actually, the publisher, Public Affairs, called me and asked me if I would be interested in writing a book about this phase of the war. And the founder, Peter Osnos, actually, we had a long discussion about Crichton Abrams, the general in the Vietnam War in the latter phase, and kind of what the possible parallels might be. A reputedly very intelligent general coming in with perhaps the right approach, but possibly too late to make a difference.
This Tuesday, he'll be handing over his command in Iraq to his deputy, General Raymond Odierno, and he'll move to Tampa, Florida. This comes as a big surprise to me. Here he is. He's having a real impact, and he's giving it all up?
I was surprised, too, frankly, simply because watching the events unfold and the strategy they were applying and things beginning to change there on the ground, I was surprised when he told me that he was had talked to President Bush about moving on, and this was last January when they met in Kuwait. And I was quite surprised simply because the job there isn't done, and we can talk about that. But he wanted very much to go to NATO, to have the four-star command there, for a number of reasons. He had served there twice. His father-in-law, General Bill Knowlton, had wound up his career there. His wife speaks three languages of the continent. Holly's very a bright woman and a great asset for a general to have. So for all these reasons, most of all, though, he wanted to get out of the firing line.
Tampa, Florida seems like an odd place to have the central command.
Well, you're right, but it's always been based there. They do travel tremendously, and that was one reason why he wanted to get some distance between himself and Iraq, I think, politically. But the people, Jack Keane and people in the White House, were just very unwilling for him to completely disappear from the Iraq problem.
So he'll be in charge of Iraq and Afghanistan from that distance?
In fact, yes, the entire Middle East and South Asia area. So he'll still have an eye on Iraq, also inheriting now Iran, all of the rest of the Middle East, and then up to Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Did he ever talk to you about the toll that serving in Iraq has taken on his personal life? I mean, his wife And family remained here, didn't they?
Yes, that's right. And I, as with all of the generals and every soldier there, they're unaccompanied tours. They're only soldiers over there. He said that when I said, why would you want to go now when the job isn't done and your legacy could possibly come apart here? And he said, give me a break. I mean, I'm human too. I mean, the man has phenomenal energy and all of that. But he just said, I've served. It will be, I think it's 5 years or more total with you. Look at his total deployment since 2001. So he did say he was tired. And also, as we discussed it, he said, look, this job is not going to be done by January or February. It's not like extending for another 6 months would have brought us to a point of conclusion.
In fact, the title of your book, Tell Me How This Ends, is from something he said to Rick Atkinson in 2003, way before we knew just how bogged down we would become.
That's right. He, because of his experience, he'd really focused on what were called small wars or low-intensity conflicts for both his academic studies and his career being deployed in Haiti and the Balkans and Central America. So he really understood that these kinds of murky conflicts were not quickly ended by dropping a bunch of bombs. And so he knew very early on the aftermath was going to be complicated.
Was he telling Washington that? Because other people, when they tried, got into trouble, didn't they?
Well, two-part answer, if I may there. He was sent up to Mosul in northern Iraq as a two-star division commander, so he had several layers above him, although Paul Wolfowitz was on the phone with him fairly frequently getting updates, the former Deputy Secretary of the Pentagon. But the main clash that Petraeus had was with Jerry Bremer, who was the Occupation Authority Administrator, and he really shut down the attempts at reconciliation with the Sunni and Baathist population that Petraeus was trying even then in 2003. But if you also want to refer to the recent remarks reported by Casey that he was trying to tell President Bush that the war wasn't going well and just getting from Bush, let's, you know, quote, kill the bastards. I think there was a lack of strategic understanding of the war on the part of General Casey, and that the White House was dithering and in a muddle over the central dynamic of the war themselves, but they were not, I think, well served by the advice they were getting on the ground.
My guest is Linda Robinson, who's written Tell Me How This Ends, General David Petraeus and the Search for a Way Out of Iraq, published by Public Affairs. And the title seems a little ironic now that he is actually leaving. He knows how it ends for him anyway. But you say that at the beginning he felt that Jerry Bremer was messing up. He's not the only person who doesn't seem to feel that way is Jerry Bremer, who wrote a book explaining that what he did was perfectly fine. But you've said that much of what General Petraeus has done in more recent years has been an attempt to undo all the earlier mistakes. So he watched as things got messed up, and then he tried to undo them. Does that include one of the most important things that Jerry Bremer has been blamed for, the de-Baathification?
Yes, exactly. And I think it's important. You know, there were a lot of moving parts to this war. A lot of times I'm reminded of the blind men and the elephant, and everyone's describing their own phase or part or location of this. But the central driver of this conflict was we go in, we topple Saddam, then you issue Decree 1 and 2, which disbands the Ba'ath Party and the Iraqi security forces, thus ensuring a Sunni insurgency would ensue. It might have ensued anyway, but this really sealed it. And then you enshrine a Shia Islamist coalition in power through elections that the Sunnis boycott and allow that parliament to write a constitution that enshrines that agenda. So then you have set the stage and lit the match for a civil war. And this is what Petraeus realized had happened. And he brought together a lot of smart people, many of them out of uniform. And that's, I think, really one of the key things that is Petraeus's legacy. He knew that he had to rely on experts, academic experts, diplomatic experts. And so he brought together this multidisciplinary team to study the problem and get to a strategy that would deal with the political motivations for those fighting.
Well, the other day I had a strategist from the U.S. Naval College here, and he said that one of the big problems we've had with Iraq and elsewhere is that we're still fighting the Cold War, even though the situation is totally different. In the case of General Petraeus, before he became the commander, he served two terms in Iraq, but he'd also overseen the writing of a new Army Marine Corps counterinsurgency manual. So he's trying to rethink how the world is today and how you fight a war?
Yes, at least these kinds of, so-called low-intensity conflicts, although this one was quite high-intensity in my observation of it. But at any rate, and that's where I first met General Petraeus. I was invited to a workshop to comment on a draft they'd produced of this manual, and he pursued the same kind of big tent approach, getting a lot of academics, human rights folks, and people to come in and help advise, because there was knowledge about counterinsurgency in the U.S. body politic, but it hadn't been tapped. He applied the main principle in Iraq, which was a population-centric approach, going for securing the population and then reaching out to those fighting who were ready to be reconciled.
How much of his thinking came from his study of the Vietnam War?
His PhD dissertation was on the Vietnam War and more precisely on the effect that Vietnam had on the thinking of the top military officials, that post-Vietnam generation. And that's where you got, the Colin Powell doctrine that don't go in unless you go in with massive force and with a clear exit strategy and all of that. And his view was rather different. He said, these small wars are going to be around, and we're going to have to deal with them. We, as the world's leader, are going to be dragged into some of these things, and we have to be prepared to deal with them. How do we deal with them? And what kinds of tools do we have to approach them other than just raw, brute military force?
In last Tuesday's New York Times, Erica Good called the security shift in Iraq's Anbar province, I'm quoting, one of the starkest turnabouts in the country since the war began 5.5 years ago. Now, Anbar was one of the most violent areas in Iraq just 2 to 3 years ago. In 2005 and 2006, a U.S. service person was killed there almost every day. So to what extent can the security improvements in Anbar be attributed to the troop surge that began in early 2007?
There are two things here that are very important, and this is discussed a lot because there was a bottom-up tribal engagement going on there before Petraeus got there and the surge started.
He wasn't one of the major proponents of the surge, was he?
That was all being decided as when he was out at Fort Leavenworth, and the White House really saw it was losing the war, and they were saying, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And they came up with the put more troops in. But I really think it's very important for people to understand it was not just numbers of troops. Critically, it was how they were used and these political methods that really turned it around. But back to Anbar very quickly. He did three things that were critical to sealing the success of Anbar, because you had the tribes coming over, and that was the bottom-up approach, but he wanted to institutionalize it, and he pressured Maliki into letting these Anbari Klansmen join the Iraqi police and the Iraqi army. He also got some of them onto the provincial council, so they had a seat in the government, and sent a lot of money out there from the central government. And this kind of institutionalizing of it meant they weren't going to be the Crips and the Bloods fighting out there. It was giving them an actual seat in the regional government. And he's trying to do the same thing with the central government and Baghdad, because in my view, actually, Baghdad was the bloodiest scene. That was the heart of the sectarian cleansing that was going on in 05 and 06. So the turnaround in Baghdad's even more dramatic, and that all occurred under the Petraeus tour.
And we'll come back to that after we take a little break. My guest is Linda Robinson, who's author in residence at the Philip Merrill Center for Strategic Studies at the Johns Hopkins School for Advanced International Studies. She is also with – are you still with U.S. World News?
I'm a contributing editor, but I'm with the Merrill Center at this point. That's my full-time position.
And her book, Tell Me How This Ends, General David Petraeus and the Search for a Way Out of Iraq, is published by Public Affairs. Stay with us for more. We're back with Linda Robinson, author of Tell Me How This Ends, General David Petraeus and the Search for a Way Out of Iraq, published by Public Affairs. General Petraeus has been able to win the allegiance of many Sunni insurgents, the group known as the Awakening, by paying them to work as security guards and police officers. How important has the Awakening movement been in cutting down the violence in Iraq? Is it just in Anbar, or is it in other areas as well?
It's all over, wherever the Sunni population is. And actually, this outreach initiative also was extended to the Shia armed groups as well. It's critical. In my view, there were many methods that went and had some effect, but I think this is probably the most critical one, because these are the people who were fighting and their support base, who, when the U.S. reached out its hand, and Petraeus was very key in extending this nationwide. He told all of his commanders June 2nd, 2007, reconciliation works, get out there and do it. So all these battalion commanders began going out and meeting with influential Sunnis, the imams in the mosques, and insurgents themselves. And the payments, you know, a lot of people here think that they switched because they were getting $10 a day. That's really so inaccurate. I'm hoping that I can put that one to rest. These people's backs were against the wall. We have to understand there was a sectarian cleansing campaign going on against them, very akin to what happened in the Balkans. These people were being driven from their homes, killed in the middle of the night by the Shia militias and the Shia police, with the connivance of the Shia-led government. So when Petraeus said, reach out your hand to these people, we're no longer going to treat the Sunnis as the enemies, my God, the Sunnis were like, this is our salvation. This is our last chance. So they came on board.
So the critics are wrong when they suggest that this is only a temporary solution. We're in effect buying off the insurgents, and that their real allegiance will always be to the highest bidder.
I think the money angle is wrong. I do not think, though, the die is cast. And the reason is the government of Nouri al-Maliki has not yet embraced this. They've committed to incorporating 20,000 of these people in the security forces. They've only incorporated 5,000. And they, at bottom, are still playing winner-take-all. It's really about whether the Iraqi government is going to make a place for the Sunnis in the government, the economy, and the security system.
So isn't there trouble ahead? The New York Times reported that in October, the Iraqi government will take over responsibility for paying and directing 54,000 members of the Sunni Awakening Councils. They'll be taking it over from the American government.
Right. This has been part of a plan to get them to take responsibility and, again, to act on their commitments. But
is that General Petraeus' plan?
Yes. Yes, that is. And I went actually to visit some of the neighborhoods that I've been tracking closely. And the battalion commanders there said, well, our fallback plan is we've already renewed their contracts into March, so that if the Iraqi government, in fact, fails to take over payment of them, they already have the mechanism to continue. I think that it is going to take holding the Maliki government's feet to the fire for many months to come to get this to happen.
And what will happen if this is not a smooth transition? Is there a plan to take it back?
To take what?
For the United States to say, well, okay, well, the Shiite government isn't doing this particularly well. We'd better step in again.
I think it's up to the next president to make this one of the conditions for further U.S. assistance. That's how important I think this actually is. And I want to also add that there has been some, you know, it has been a pushing struggle every step of the way. Petraeus and Crocker, we should also talk about the U.S. ambassador, who's been a very key partner in all of this, but they have gone to the mat with Maliki behind closed doors, you know, day after day. But in Amaria, one of the worst neighborhoods that has turned around, I went to visit, and I found that, in fact, there are police on the job there, and they are former Sons of Iraq, these Awakening members, and they, 170 members, have gotten through the police academy. So it's happening, but it's just not happening enough.
And obviously things are changing, because a couple of years ago we would hear about bombings, suicide bombings, with killing off recruits to the police as a way of discouraging people from being part of that. That's all been eliminated pretty much?
Well, the car bomb networks were really, that was a tactic used by the Sunni insurgency.
The people who are now in the awakening.
That's right. Great lethal effect. And there were some of the so-called irreconcilables that, in fact, yes, were killed and captured. So I don't want to make it sound like 100% of these people came over to the U.S. side. But they did. I think you still have some incidents of car bombs, some suicide bombers, things like that. But the levels are just dramatically lower. I was surprised going back for this last visit last week to see how much better life is for the average person now.
General Petraeus told you that he understood before he took command in Iraq that military force alone wouldn't be sufficient to end the conflict there, that a political solution had to be found. Was the lack of a political solution in the early planning a major problem for the kind of chaos that we have seen in Iraq until fairly recently?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that just the failure to understand the political consequences of our actions was the entire story here, so that we, by disenfranchising not just the relatively small number of Saddamists, but the entire Sunni population, we created this insurgency. And the Shia, you know, the Islamist Shia parties have an agenda, and we need to understand that. We also need to understand they don't represent the entirety of the Shia population there. And I think that if an astute policy can be crafted, people will understand that these parts of Iraq can coexist together. They can reach a condominium. We just have got to pursue a more sensible policy to get there.
He also taught the troops under his command to think of the political consequences of their actions. Well, when you're an occupying force, how do you do that?
I'll give you some very concrete examples, because what was happening a lot in the earlier phases of the war was troops were going to conduct raids on houses, kicking in the door in the same house five times. They found nobody there they were after. And, of course, what's going to happen to that Iraqi family? They're going to get really ticked off.
And they were always angry because the men, they felt, the American troops, were disrespecting their women.
Absolutely. So you just really have to have absolutely great intel before you launch any kind of raid and try to use the minimum amount of air power. So what happened when you flipped the Sunni insurgency with this Sons of Iraq movement? Those people had the human intelligence. They had been fighting with them. They knew where their caches were. They knew where the ringleaders were. So they provided a real treasure trove of intelligence. The other thing that happened was a biometric registry of a lot of young Iraqi men, the sort of pool of insurgents. So you now had, for the first time, a computerized, shareable database, again, to avoid going after the wrong people and try to isolate the right people. So these were two really key steps in what was called the population-centric approach to this war.
My guest is Linda Robinson. Her book, Tell Me How This Ends, General David Petraeus and the Search for a Way Out of Iraq, published by Public Affairs. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Before he resigned in November 2006, two months before General Petraeus was brought on board, hadn't Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld pretty much made all of the decisions about what was going to happen in Iraq, the conduct of the war and the politics of the situation as well?
He was a huge, huge influence. And as we know from very early on, even before the Bush administration came into office, he was not a proponent of anything like nation building. You know, he just wanted to topple the regime and get out and let the Iraqis do it themselves. So he was never really willing to grapple with the consequences of having set off an insurgency and then a civil war. But I do not think it is fair to lay it all at his feet, because the thinking of both General John Abizaid, the Central Command chief, and General George Casey, who was the four-star in Iraq, was very much that the U.S. presence was creating the insurgency. And I think they misread what was really going on, because the Sunnis saw the U.S. as having cast their lot with the side of the Shia Islamists who'd gone into power. So they saw us as being allied with the people who were out to kill them.
But it's my sense that Robert Gates has made a different kind of a deal with General Petraeus and said, I'm giving you a lot more leeway here. I'm not going to be micromanaging you as Rumsfeld might have.
Yes, absolutely. I think that it's certainly going to come out in the years ahead when we have declassified things, how much George Casey was micromanaged by Rumsfeld. But I think that it would be wrong to exonerate Casey from his failure to grasp what was really going on in Iraq. Gates has given Petraeus a lot of rope, but there's been constant pressure from the Pentagon to draw down forces and declare the surge to be over, both from the uniformed and civilian leadership. And I think the record should be very clear on this. The entire military and political establishment of Washington was against the surge, and including Secretary of State Rice and other people, the Iraq Study Group. I mean, people did not want to put more troops in there. But Gates has understood that, and I think he understands the political aspect of this, although he doesn't speak to it very much. He understands that these wars have to be fought using State Department and other people, too.
And defenders of the war effort keep on saying to any critics, well, we just have to trust General Petraeus, as though he really is running the whole show.
I think that Bush gave him a long leash. I think it would be fair to say that, at least in terms of the troop levels, which is what everyone is so focused on here, and I try to push back against that because I think, for example, right now we're on a downward path. There is absolutely no question we're continuing the drawdown. It will continue to go down to some level. We can debate, but I would guess around a 5 to 7 brigade level is where we would probably wind up under either president. I'd go so far to guess, but in a non-combat mode. But I think the other parts of the strategy, the political approach was developed in Baghdad and carried out in Baghdad. Crocker and Petraeus at the helm, but a lot of people around them supporting them and informing them with their expertise.
General Petraeus has been getting a lot of attention lately. He was the subject of a New Yorker piece by Steve Call. There's your book. He's constantly being praised by politicians. Was he just the right man at the right time, or does he possess personal qualities that helped him succeed where others had failed?
I think that he was the right man. The way I think of it is he was a very political general in all senses of the word. I mean, the man's quite ambitious, but he's also a very smart man and very energetic, and it takes all of that to try to crack this nut. But I think the political general part is what enabled him to wade into the politics of Iraq. That was something General Casey, General Peter Pace, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, these generals are very uncomfortable with the political side of war. But guess what? War is politics, as we know our Clausewitz. So this man was willing to go behind closed doors with Maliki, a lot of stratagems and maneuvers. He'd threaten people, he'd browbeat people, and he got them to act.
You mentioned that he knew his Clausewitz. He also knew his U.S. Grant, and he was a student of Grant's efforts to turn around the foundering Union Army. Do you think that we'll be reading similar kinds of accounts in the future, or military people will, about Petraeus?
I think there'll be a lot written about this. I think there is a lot to learn from this, and not just the history of Iraq, and so I wouldn't, I'd be very surprised if there weren't historians working on this for years.
You've included a chapter at the end of your book full of advice about Iraq for whoever the next president turns out to be. How fragile is the progress that's been made so far?
Well, I'm conservatively saying the glass is half full because I do think a great deal needs to be done. But on the political front, it's no longer a military job, really at all, in my view.
I mean, it's unlikely we'll see something similar to what happened in Vietnam where everybody thought, well, we've turned the corner, everything's okay, and then the Tet Offensive blew everything up?
That is the big danger, and that's why I actually left my journalist cubbyhole and said, I got to tell you my views of what I think needs to happen. If we simply shift all of our focus over to Afghanistan and draw out all troops precipitously, we will lose that war because the civil war will begin again. I have no question of that, and you can destabilize the region very easily through that.
Of course, the critics of staying there say, well, we shouldn't have been there in the first place and we should just get out.
Right, and history may well say this was a war that shouldn't have been fought, but I think the judgment of history will be even harsher if we don't bring this to a successful conclusion. And that, again, I want to emphasize, this is not about leaving combat troops there. This is about much more of a low-level peacekeeping mold and using the leverage that we have, because they still need us for the personal security of these leaders, for one thing, but also the what they call the combat enablers, medevac, air, intelligence, logistics help. They still need a lot of help from us, and they know it, even though they are bargaining very hard in this bilateral accord.
And you, one major piece of advice you have for the next president, whether it's Barack Obama or John McCain, is that he should continue to maintain a focus on the balance of power that's developed between the Shia majority and the Sunni minority.
Yes, you absolutely have to put conditions on Maliki government, say, you need our help, this is in return, you've got to do this, and not just incorporate the Sons of Iraq and the security force, but also provides services to the Shia Sunni areas that have been starved of services. The Amaria neighborhood's still only getting 2 to 6 hours of power in Baghdad, where others are getting 12. So there's a clear disparity.
We do understand that there's a revenge factor here. For years, the Sunni minority oppressed the Shiite majority, and now the Shiites are in power. This is not an unusual situation.
It is not, and there is a very deep urge for revenge, but also Iraq's an extremely wealthy country, so there's also a contest for that, to grab onto the wealth of Iraq. And all I'm saying is I don't at all diminish the suffering the Shias went through. You're simply going to get a continued killing if you don't broker an accord. And I believe because Iraqis do have a sense of nationalism more than has been recognized in most of the reporting in this country, they I think, want to remain a state. And I think for us to preside over a couple more million Iraqis getting killed would really be morally reprehensible.
Just one more thing. You mentioned that it's a wealthy country, and billions of dollars actually have in oil sales are now being kept kind of like an escrow. The United States continues to build up the infrastructure of Iraq. And as Joseph Stiglitz has pointed out, he's projecting $5 trillion when this whole thing is over many years from now, when we add every possible thing together. We're paying for the buildup of the infrastructure, and Iraq is paying for nothing.
Yes, I think we're certainly at the point now where the Iraqis can begin to pay the lion's share of it. We have to note, though, because the troop levels are going to go down, I would guess, at about a brigade a month, about the pace they've been going down, and that's going to dramatically reduce the cost. It just, you know, we burn a lot of money over there with that big, heavy military footprint that, in my view, is really not needed anymore. It can't physically leave overnight. I mean, there's just too big a logistic headache, but I think you've got now that I think the price tag is something like $859 billion for this war and the Afghanistan war. And I think absolutely the American people don't want to keep paying at this rate, and I don't think we will.
Linda Robinson's book, Tell Me How This Ends, General David Petraeus and the Search for a Way Out of Iraq, is published by Public Affairs. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Leonard.